Today is Sunday, August 23rd. This is Linda Lenski, and today I have the honor of interviewing Faye Farrington. Faye, as a starting point, why don't you tell us a little bit about your date of birth, where you were born, and a little bit about your family of origin, just so we have sort of a foundation for your story.
Okay. I was born in Buffalo, New York in 1937. I was the fifth child, but the first daughter. And I think that probably had a lasting influence throughout at least my first 20 years, because I had a very special welcome, but I also had a very emotionally charged welcome. So anyway. In preparing for this and thinking about it, it dawned on me that if you're being interviewed, in a sense, you're being asked, "Who are you?" And that led me into sort of a characterization of my life overall, and it was. Sort of enlightening that it has applied all through from when I was very, very young. And that is to say that I would characterize my life overall as a searching, as a restlessness, testing. And then I happen to think, well, these have different values. Some of those are very admirable, and some of them could be not so admirable. But anyway, basically, it boils down to a great sense of initiative from when I can first remember, which was when I was less than 2 years old. And I came up with a couple of examples to illustrate this. And I thought I'd tell them. Well, first is the dog story. And I don't think I've told you that. Good, okay. Well, after I was born in Buffalo, we lived there a year or so, and then we moved out into the country, and we didn't have a farm yet. That was way later. But we rented from somebody who had a farm. And I saw them milking the cows and everything, and so by this time I was probably two. And so I thought, I would try that. So I got the dog, male dog, got a kettle, put it down below the dog. The dog didn't complain at all. Dog stood there. I was milking the dog. And I think that shows a certain amount of inquiry and restlessness and wanting to get involved in things. Mother differed with me, but anyway. Another example of that was they used to have a saying, maybe you are familiar with it, you have to eat a peck of dirt before you die. And this was, again, about that same period of time, and I thought, I mean, I can't recall the exact words, but I thought, I better get on with it. So I did. I started eat some dirt, and it was ridiculous. So I quit that after a couple of mouthful. But anyway, I was always looking into things, and those are some examples. I mentioned that, well, my welcoming into the family was very special. It also had some baggage connected to it too. I think I think mother probably anticipated, oh my goodness, at last I have my little girl. Now I'll have her little patent leather shoes, and we'll have, you know, and that never was how it went. I think her view of a little girl was dolls and everything, you know. And that was not who I was. However, she did start something with me then that you could almost say was a mantra. Faye's going to be a nurse when she grows up. Well, now, mind you, I'm like 2-3 years old. So I would go around, I got a lot of attention doing this. I'd go around to people and I'd say, I'm going to be a nurse when I grow up. And they always, you know, so that was great. I liked that. So despite the fact there was this, right from the very beginning, there was this initiative on my part and this mother wanting me to be a mellow, malleable little girl. And so there was the tension right from the start. I had four brothers alive at that point, and they were, so there was a lot of competition with them also right from the start. I wanted to do everything they did, of course, and everybody does, and I assume. And of course they didn't want me around, which is the way brothers are with little girls, I assume. I played a lot alone. This is going on up through, as I started school, played a lot alone. I liked books, I liked drawing pictures. And of course, with wanting to be with my brothers, I liked all sports. And we weren't exactly poor, but we didn't have any of the stuff that typifies affluent life nowadays. So my brothers would make things to play with, you know, like we, by this time now we're on the farm, by the way, I forgot to mention that. And we were tapping trees, maple trees. And so we, my brothers took one of the syrup buckets and knocked the bottom out of it and pounded it up in the hay mow and wound up a burlap bag real tight with string, and that was our basketball. So we had that version of every sport that you could think of, including golf and pool. But I remember starting school. I mean, it was no big deal. I noticed some of the odd behavior of the other kids, and things progressed. And by the time I got to be in the third grade, there were things that as I was reviewing my life, I decided to highlight because they sort of bring out certain indications of where my life would go. And so when I was in the third grade, we were playing some game and run around the room. And I can remember my disdain for this young boy who was a friend of mine, because he let a girl catch him. And I said, oh, Charlie, you let that girl catch you. Well, I mean, I don't know what I thought I was, but, you know, it's kind of odd when you stop and think about it. I guess I didn't think too much about whether I was a boy or a girl. I just always liked boys' clothes. Mother never let me wear them till I was 9 or 10, 12, I guess. And so I never had any jeans on or anything. But we're on the farm now, so everybody worked out in the fields. And I competed with my brothers for Dad's attention. Somehow Mother's attention had become less than valuable. And probably that says something about how women are or are not valued and how early in life little girls learn this. Anyway. So I was competing for Dad's attention, and by way of, I was always trying to show him how strong I was and how much work I could do. And I hated housework. Mother made me work in the house at least on Saturdays. And guess what that work was? It was cleaning up my brother's bedroom. My brothers, I would say, were probably as exuberant about where they threw their clothes as most little boys are. And so it was quite an undertaking, and I resented it very much. And it, again, it just added to the not real good atmosphere. I did have another one of these events that I think points in the direction of where my life was going to go, unbeknownst to me. On farms back then, especially, they would share heavy machinery so that everybody wouldn't have to buy it and go broke and get subsidized by the government and, et cetera. So we had one thrashing machine for the village. And so you went thrashing when the grain was ripe. That is to say that the person who owned the tractor and the thrashing machine or ran it as a co-op or whatever it was would go to somebody's house, and then all the men from the village would go to that house and that farm, and they'd all harvest oats or wheat or whatever it was they were working on. And of course it was up to mother then, or the mother in the household, I assume, but to say with us, it was up to mother to prepare this massive meal for 8 or 10 men. Now, mind you, she also, by this time, had 6 kids. I had mentioned I was the 5th child born. The first one hadn't lived, so then I had the 3 boys who were alive, and then me, and then she wanted to have she wasn't supposed to have any more children, but she wanted very much to have a sister for me. I don't think that would have changed anything, but I think she thought it might, and she tried twice, but 2 more boys. So that didn't work out to her advantage. Going back to the thrashing, what my event was, I could never go. The boys could always go. And you'd go off to somebody's farm, and they'd do this work, and then they'd go in, and they'd have this huge meal with everybody celebrating, I could never go. Well, finally one day, Dad let me go. And I felt stupendous. I had on a pair of jeans. I had a shirt from one of my older brothers. I was out there with the rake and the pitchfork, and I just was as happy as I'd ever been. And again, that I think fits into where I've been. Mother resented this. Mother resented Dad having me. She said, "You have her out in the field all the time." Well, that's where I wanted to be all the time. So anyway, But up through then, after the thrashing event and so forth, by now I'm about 9, 10 years old. And in that interval from the 4th grade to the 10th grade, we went to this wooden schoolhouse, which it did have about 5 or 6 rooms, but it was in the country and it was decentralized, and the kids would take turn ringing the bell for noon hour, and we had a big pot-bellied stove as you came in, and it was nice as I look back now, but I thought it was kind of not very fancy, because we had our first couple of years. We had lived near a town where they had a brick schoolhouse and everything, So, anyway. So from the 4th to the 10th grade, I went to the school, and I might mention, I suppose, at the end of the during the 4th grade, my teacher talked to me and asked me to tell my mother that maybe I should skip the 5th grade. And for some reason or another, I was walking home that day, which was not a usual occurrence. It was about 2 miles. So I thought about it all the way home. I thought, I'm going to introduce fractions in the fifth grade. And that doesn't seem to me like a thing that you'd want to skip. And so when I got home, I told Mother, Mrs. Nelson suggested that I skip fifth grade, but I've decided not to. Well, you know, what are you going to do with a kid like that? So, things that happened in that interval, those 6 years, my fifth grade teacher gave me a book called Little Women. I read it. I loved it. I cried and cried because Joe was dead. And why wasn't there anybody like Joe around anymore? And I might throw in something here about, I've gotten into genealogy recently. And also I've been taking classes, which I'll mention sometime later, at the Senior Center. And one of the classes we took at the Senior Center was Transcendentalism. And of course, that was the whole atmosphere of intellectual inquiry and philosophy of day-to-day living came from that particular approach, or the, as it came to be known anyway, as Transcendentalism, involving Thoreau and Emerson, Thoreau, Hawthorne, and the father of the woman who wrote Little Women, Bronson, and what was her?
Was it Emily?
No, not Emily. Oh Lord, well I can't think of it. Anyway, so in the class, it was having this early experience with Little Women and the woman who had written it and so forth, and sort of having in the back of my mind that she was probably Jo, and indeed she probably was. And I really looked into that in some depth. And I also, in looking into genealogy nowadays, I actually went back and looked up her family in the census records. And that was kind of fun too. But one of the things that struck me was when women in that area, particularly in New England, were abolitionists, and they were abolitionists long before it was cool to be an abolitionist. And Louisa May Alcott wrote the book. Okay, right. And Louisa May was an abolitionist also. But anyway, the Civil War broke out, and what struck me when I was doing all this research a couple of years ago, going back to the Little Women experience, she said, I had read a number of other things that she had written and got them off the internet and stuff. She had different letters and whatnot and so forth. So one of the things she had said that then when the war started and all the boys left for the war, she thought she was supposed to too. And that's just the way I felt later in a different situation. She became an army nurse. And she went to Washington, and the rest everybody knows probably, but I mean, she got very ill and paid for that dearly the rest of her life. But that struck me, especially the part where she said she thought, well, she was supposed to go too, and she couldn't. But she did the best she could. So anyway, okay, all of that was to tie in the experience of Joe and who Joe might have been and who Louisa May Alcott was, and that meant a lot to me, and still does. And it's really wonderful to have it all tie into transcendentalism then later on in life. When I was in the seventh grade, I started to worship my teacher, who was 21 years old. It was Miss Manella. Oh, God love her, she'd die if it... Anyway, and I was very open about my feelings about her. I mean, I told you it was a little school. There were only five of us in this class. And I said to Sue one day, there was like Sue and Glenda and Louie and Mike and me, and if that's five, whatever. Anyway, I said to Sue one day, oh, I just can't wait to see what she's wearing every morning. And Sue said, I've read in my mother's True Story magazines about girls like that. Maybe you're one of those girls. So she told Miss Manella. Miss Manella said, that is ridiculous. This is just a natural phase that teenagers go through. And of course, that was another telling episode, I suppose. I maintained a relationship with her for 6 or 7 years and made a point of doing so. There were other people in that era. Let's see, there was early to mid-50s, early 50s, and television was just coming into the fore, and our neighbors had a television, and I saw a program one night with this band with doing country music, and there was the guy, Art Young, for posterity art. It was Donna Lee. She was the, quote, girl singer that everybody had back then. They still have, but they don't dare call them that. And, of course, sometimes the girl singers have the whole bunch. But anyway, my gosh, she was a wonderful person. So without being invited to, I just went over every Tuesday night to the neighbor's house, and they weren't on until 11 o'clock at night, but I just went over there every night and saw her, and it was just heaven, and then we got a TV, and this teaches you things about life, too. That's a preface statement. We got the TV, on a Thursday or whatever, and the next Tuesday, it was time for Donna and Art and the show on, and they had gone off the air. Mm. Well, I couldn't believe it, you know. By now I'm like 13 or 14, so. But anyway, found out my uncle knew them, one of my uncles, and he got me pictures from Donna and autographs and... I went up to, and then I requested songs, that they do a song for my uncle. And so then they said, oh, of course, well, you know, Ted Strang is our good friend, blah, blah, blah. And so I went up to the studio. Now, it took some engineering to get from our farm to the studio in Buffalo. But I got there with a little help from various and sundry relatives, with whom I had never visited before. But anyway, so and then I would go in there then every summer, and I would go down to the radio station, and then I'd go out and follow them around to their different places where they were. I notice I'm including a lot of stuff here. Anyway, they were where they were playing. And I remember this one particular time, especially, Donna came over to me. I was 15 at the time. And she said, come on, let's get our picture taken together. And she took my hand and I almost collapsed. That was the first time I was ever aware of any kind of feeling, physical feeling toward a woman. But I didn't know what it was. So I got a guitar. I sent to Sears and Roebuck. I got a guitar. I was going to be a country and western singer. And over the years, that sort of faded from my agenda. And about 6 or 8 years later, I ran into Art in a bar, Art Young in a bar in Buffalo. And he and Donna had separated. I let him know that I played the guitar, and he said, oh, well, come on out. We're going to be playing it thus and such. He said, come on out and jam with us. So I did. And I had to just sort of chuckle because I was only about 19, and already I had fulfilled a dream, you know, playing with Art. And so I did a song of Donna's, and I did it just exactly the way she did it, you know. And then he asked me if I wanted to join their group. And so, no, because I was going to be a nurse, you know. And that's what I was doing, studying nursing. So, in the process of studying nursing, freshman psychology, we learned about homosexuals, as the British say. And one day my psychology instructor, Mr. Braley, asked me to come visit him in his office. So I did. And he said he noticed that when we were covering this certain subject matter that, well, he didn't know if he would call it defensive necessarily, but I really stuck up for these people, these homosexuals. Yeah. And he said, you may want to be careful about that. Mm. Now I'm 18, you know. And that's 1955. And looking back, I think now Mr. Braley was probably gay. But it's sad that it was such a dire circumstance surrounding anything having to do with being gay that he would feel that he should warn an 18-year-old teenager about not letting your feelings show in public. Hmm. Shortly after that, I got a hold of The Well of Loneliness. I read it. I loved Stephen. Cry. Did you read it?
It's been a long time.
Yeah, well, of course, this was a long time. Cried, showed other people. I said, you know, I still hadn't put it all together. And nobody else cried. They thought, ugh, you know, they just. And I said, but look what happened to her, you know. And it was soon after that I began to figure out. I sort of started to put things together. I was hanging around with this one boy at the time, and his name was Don. Subparagraph, whatever here. Mm-hmm. And Don and I would have long philosophical discussions into the night, of course, at 18. And finally one night he said to me, he was from New York City, so and his family had a little bit of money and stuff, and he said, my father has sent me to see a psychoanalyst. He said, I'm a homosexual. And I said, well, I think I am too. And it was first I had put it all together. And it was nice and safe, too, because, you know, Don took the first step. But I might have, but I just wasn't aware. So we went downtown Buffalo because we'd heard there were bars where these people hung out. So we went down in these all these cruddy neighborhoods, you know, and we looked. And, of course, here's a teenage boy and girl. And what are they looking for? They're looking for a gay bar. Now, who's going to know that, you know? So it was kind of funny. But and I stay in touch with Don. I met Arlene in school, second year of nursing school. Really was my first, what would you say, minor love affair, I guess. And all right, I'm laughing because I have no intent to be getting even with people here, but I must say, it is amusing to me anyway. Arlene was a Christian, a Reformed church member, a Calvinist, her family. And we were always together for about 6 weeks during this one affiliation where we were both at this hospital. Excuse me. And we did some physical things. We didn't consummate our relationship, but we were, you know, cuddly and touchy. And then the 6 weeks was over and Arlene had to go back to Rochester, New York. And that was like 50 miles away. And, you know, we would write letters and stuff and we'd get to see each other once in a while. But she wouldn't have anything to do with me anymore, physically. No cuddling, nothing, no touching. No, it's wrong. It's against God's will. It's sinful. So I thought, my God, what faith she must have, you know? I mean, because I'm not about to willingly give this up for God's will. And so one day I was visiting her and I was looking at her Bible, which was, you know, a Bible was something that we looked at fairly often. And I'm thumbing through her Bible and there's a little note in there. To my sweet Peggy. Hmm. I thought, that wasn't God at all. That was Peggy. Peggy wouldn't like it if we did that. So I was angry about that. I suppose that's a good way not to feel too hurt, you know. But I forged ahead. I ran into another woman that year, and I was living in the dorm, and she said she was listening to me tell somebody how I had a paper due the next day, and I couldn't stay up. I couldn't type it because there was no place to type it except a bathroom, and that was too noisy. So she was a grad student, as it turns out, and she says, well, you come down to my room, type it if you'd like. So, you know, off I went, typewriter in hand. Well, you never saw a better seduction in your life. And then finally, toward the end of the evening, we went over to the drugstore to get something. And she said, do you want something? And I said, no. And she said, not that you can get in here anyway, huh? And we went back to her room and she kissed me. And just for about 5 seconds, I thought, well, this is kind of funny, you know? And then I felt intensely involved physically. And so we spent the night together. And so the next day, well, of course, I had my paper wasn't done. I had an exam the next day. I'm floating down to the university. I didn't give a damn. And because the next day I was going to go back down to see her, which I did. And I got to the door and locked the door, and she said, "What are you doing here?" And that was the end of that. So I met another woman. She knew where the bars were. She knew what to do. So we started, gonna go down to the bar the first time in my life, you know. So if you're going downtown, you get dressed up, right? Mm-hmm. I think I've told you this.
Tell me again.
Okay, so if you're going downtown, now this is 57, and I get my little ballerinas on, and you know, my stockings and my plaid skirt and boat neck sweater and everything, and I go downtown, and holy crying out loud. The only women I found out who went to bars back then were the dykes. Mm-hmm. Well, hello there. Hello. I warded off several folk that night and ended up going home with this one woman because I really liked talking to her. And we went to bed, and we talked until I fell asleep. And the next morning, we got up, and she took me over to work, so I'd be to work on time. And I never saw her again. And when I think of how kind she was, you know, and she was a tough dyke. So I went to the bars every night. Then I discovered them. I went for about 4 years on every night. And I met a lot of people. I hung around mostly with the guys because the women were, really, they were almost all what could you say? I didn't find them very interesting. And a lot of the guys were. I mean, they had interesting jobs and they'd been to school, and so we just had a blast. And we formed our own little cul-de-sac there at one point. We each had rented apartments and stuff, and it was, that went on we hung out together every night for about 4 years. But one night, nice from my point of view. There was a woman I liked there at the bar. And this one name was Chris.
We have plenty of time.
Okay. So her name was Chris. And so I struck up a relationship with her a little bit. And she was just a willowy thing, you know. And one night somebody came rushing up to me and said, "Chris is out in the alley, she's in a fight." And I thought, oh my God, I mean, this little wisp of a thing is going to be killed. So I raced out and negotiated a separation of the dykes and turned around to go back into the bar. And there was this woman that I had met there and gone home with 4 years, 3 years beforehand. Her name was Dusty. And Dusty was standing there in the door. And she pulled a knife out from her bra and she said, "Just in case you needed me." Oh dear, okay, thank you. Andrew Dusty. And again, that was fairly routine, sort of. That was nothing ultra dramatic for those days. I mean, with the police raids and threatened attacks and stuff.
Faye, I'd like to ask a question because I get kind of a clear picture of who Dusty is, and I have kind of a clear picture of you in that you were kind of identifying yourself and having allegiances and friendships with gay men, and that you weren't as attracted to some of what in that vernacular of that time would have been called bull daggers. And that you were probably beginning to define yourself more as butch rather than femme. Is that a fair assessment of how you were seeing yourself then? Because I know for a lot of communities, you had to fall in one camp or the other, particularly in the bars. So I just thought I'd ask that question just for clarification.
Well, I never liked that distinction. However, I did enjoy putting on my wool slacks and my bulk knit sweater and going down and to the bar and having a beer and leaning back against a wall and surveying the situation. I thought, yeah, I guess I would have to say that's, if I were to categorize myself, I'd have to say that's butch, I suppose. I suppose I already always had been.
So far in your story, what I've heard too is more with the identification with your brothers and identification with the gay men that you saw in terms of being interesting and part of your allegiance or aligning yourself with them had to do with, it sounds like what you saw as the value and the importance that men held that women didn't, and that there was an opportunity for you in this bar community to kind of have some power as a woman who considered herself more male identified in that way.
I guess so. I never thought of it that way, but I just thought of they're just, you know, like there was my best friend Jim, and Jim came from a family of five boys, all of whom were gay. He came from New York City, and I had long been enthralled with New York City and had visited a couple times. And so he was very sophisticated in my view. In fact, I gotta tell you one thing. Jim might have thought he was dealing with a diamond in the rough, I don't know. But anyway, he was about 8, 9 years older than I was. He was a businessman. And he took me out one time to help me buy a dress. So we got this kind of fine dress, you know. And then he took me out to dinner. Now, I had never been to dinner in my life. I mean, I had to have fish fries at home in the bars when I was dating boys between 16 and 18 years of age. But finishing high school and stuff. But I had never been to dinner. I mean, Aaron were sitting there, and I thought, my gosh, you know. They brought a menu and gave us each a menu, and I can't remember if Jim suggested something or not. He probably did, because I didn't know what the heck was, you know. And then they brought us a salad, and I thought, my word, when are we gonna eat? So it must have been 20 minutes, maybe. And they brought out my food. And it was a dinner plate with a baked potato and a glob about this size, maybe twice the size of the head of the microphone, about an inch and a half thick, and it was black. Hmm. And of course it was a filet mignon. Well, I thought, oh geez, I guess I gotta eat it, I guess, you know? And of course I loved it, but, yeah. It's nice that people do things like that for other people. Jim knew I'd never had any experience like that in my life, you know. So we all started, as I said, we hung around. We had marvelous times. We played, we thought we should at least one night a week not immediately go to the bars. We would have dinner at different people's houses. And then we'd play bridge. And everybody'd watch the clock until it was about 11. And then and everybody was gone, of course. We decided, I don't know if I decided or Jim or whatever, but it was really quite a wild time. I saw myself as being quite a wild creature, drinking 4 beers a night and out every night to the bars, and Jim would have the whole bar come back to his apartment, and then they'd stay until 5 in the morning. And then one morning I said to Jim, let's drive to New York City. Yeah. Let's drive to New York, of course, which meant the city. And so we did. Off we drove to New York City, and we did the town for the weekend. And another time, Camelot was opening in Toronto in their new center. God, what was the name of it? I can't remember now. But it was, so it was a big deal, because it was the opening of their huge, like the Overture Center or
right,
something.
Like Lincoln Center. Toronto's version of that.
Yeah. So we went to see Camelot, and there were all the main stars, you know. They hadn't gone to New York yet. The first act was over at 11:30 at night, so they did have some preparing to do for that. But that was a nice, that was a nice experience. So then we got out and we rushed back to Buffalo, because in Buffalo the bars didn't close until 3 a.m. and we could get there and have a drink before, you know, and so we did. Mm-hmm. And then we laughed mightily. How are we doing time, please?
We've got plenty of time.
Like another anecdote.
Yeah, we've got at least a half an hour before this sound card ends.
Okay. Yeah, this is... I told you, I mentioned that I made it my business to get to New York City a couple times. And I had run into this guy who, again, was affiliating where I was. And he probably was not gay, but he was acceptable to me. And he was from New York. And so I went down to visit Harvey. And I said, now, again, this is like 57. This is a little earlier. And by then, you know, this was like before I became a nightly bar hop. But anyway, I said to Harvey, see if you can get tickets for My Fair Lady. Well, of course, you know, I mean, if you want, you could get a ticket for 4 years down the road if you wanted. Mm-hmm. And he couldn't, of course, get any, and he did get some theater tickets. And we went to the theater, and it was so disappointing, because across the street was this big My Fair Lady, you know, and I'm thinking, oh, man. And we had to go to this other thing, that this other show that had opened up the night before called West Side Story. With Leonard Bernstein conducting. Mm-hmm. And it's just one of those things you laugh about in life, you know. God, I gotta go to this, and you know. So anyway, I just thought I'd throw that in there. When I have to digress just a bit, going back to when I was about 14, Korea, the Korean War started. Excuse me. And my brother volunteered for the Army and went to Korea. And that's where I said that I identified with Louisa May Alcott's mm-hmm. statement of, well, I should go too, you know? And that was a very uncomfortable year. Because I felt like I should be there doing something, you know. So, but, back to the present. After our 3-4 years of barring all the time, we're up to 1961, and I left Buffalo, and I went to Michigan. And I knew a couple of people who had gone out there to Ann Arbor. So I thought, well, it's time to. Now, by this time, I had graduated from nursing school about 6 months before that. And I thought, well, it's time to start seeing the world. And Michigan is as good a place to start as any, you know. So I was in Michigan for about 5.5 years, and they started a master's program while I was there in psych nursing, and I knew I wanted that eventually. So even though I was just out of school, and they had funding, so, you know. Mm-hmm. So I enrolled in that, and I met this woman at work. And she was pretty special. And I'm not sure exactly how it all came about, but eventually I was watching her two young sons when she worked shifts. And her sons were 7 and 9 at the time. 61, yeah. And well, then eventually I might as well move in with her because, you know, we could split the rent, and, you know, who had any money? Neither one of us. So that was the beginning of a 5.5 year relationship with Marion and her two sons. As far as I was concerned, I was enrolled and I was getting my master's, and I was taking a lot of photographs, and I was with Marion and the boys, and I had settled down for life. I was 23. And figured that was it, you know? And it didn't really work out quite that well. Marion had put her ex-husband through medical school, and then he was supposed to put her through school, and he didn't, of course. Mm-hmm. And by then they had the two kids, and she put herself through with the two boys. Gradually she began to worry that he might want to try to get the boys away from her, because being a lesbian was not real fashionable from 61 through 66. And she just worried more about that more and more, and it just got to be a thing, and we just didn't make it. About 20 years later, I saw her a couple times. Mm. And about 20 years later, I got a letter from her and said, don't ever contact me again for anything in any way at all. Blah, 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 blah. If it hadn't been for you, I never would have been involved in such a situation. She, by the way, was 11 years older than I. And I just figured, well, she must have flipped out or something. However, I still have, I'm in touch with the boys. Hmm. And I often wonder what they make of it now, looking back. And they don't know that she's drawn this line, because they'll say, why don't you come out? Mom's going to be 80 pretty soon, and, you know, come on out and visit. And I emailed her, and I got no answer this past summer. I said, you know, one of these days one of us is going to die, so we might as well get together a little bit. And she never answered. So I'm going to call her. Let's see what happens. During that time, I finished getting my master's in 63. I became, I was afraid to try and get it, but I turned out I could do it. And I became very energized about issues of healthcare. And I was so determined that nursing should find its role in the healthcare team, and because of what we had to contribute, and because treatment is necessary but not sufficient. Which is to say, if you don't have care, you're not going anywhere. I got involved in opening in the building of this hospital for emotionally disturbed children, and that's what I did until I left Ann Arbor. We opened it up, and they built it, and we determined absolutely everything about it, and we were all just like, I think the oldest was 31. The medical director was 31, and we just worked day and night and built it. It was supposed to have been the first of about 6 residential treatment centers for emotionally disturbed children in Michigan at the forefront of the community mental health movement, which went no place. Which meant that they opened the doors to all the state hospitals, including the one in Central Islip out at the end of Long Island that had 12,000 patients. Where I worked in making the transition into the new treatment center for kids, where I worked was in the state hospital. And that's where we developed the plans for the treatment center. And as I say, they never built any more treatment centers in Michigan. And community mental health just really went down the tube. And I went to Vietnam. There.
We paused for a moment because I wanted to check in with Faye regarding the Vietnam portion of her story, and we've decided that we're going to save that for our second interview, but Faye does have some additional things she wants to share with us this afternoon in this portion of the interview. Back to Faye.
During this, before I left and went to Michigan, during this bar era, I guess I had written things down for quite a while, actually. Different things that you could say might be called poems, but I wrote one about World War II when I was 8, 9. But that's a little embarrassing. Well, the last two lines, though, of that poem, I can... I spent all afternoon ruminating about what I was trying to write something, you know, and anyway, I wrote about the soldiers and what a terrible thing it was, and that they had to fight the Japs, and all this, and then I ended it up, and I said, and in the field where humans lay, they fought in the war that terrible day. Anyway, I wrote something in 1960, which goes along with the coming out and going to the bars and all that stuff, and addressing the world, really, or other people or whatever. This lithesome, youthful creature offends you. This gentle, searching being confounds you. Its sensitivity, cloaked so different from your own, conforms to standards devious in nature. And then, the next year, 61. This is sort of I mentioned before that I felt kind of like I was being a real wild creature going to these bars and escaping police raids and all sorts of stuff. Escaping, getting beat up like these guys were going to beat me up one night. And I said, oh, for crying out loud, guys. I said, think of my poor mother. And they said, oh, come on, Joe. And they left. But anyway, so all these things, I thought I was quite worldly. But anyway, I wrote this. I am all things to all people, yet nothing to the all one. I am you, God, and you, Satan, and child, and man in woman's body. I am omnipotence and clarity, rascal, freeman, mirror to the world, concept of conception, non-conceiving, glowing, sighing, singing, shamelessly exploring guilt, flinging body and soul in muddy snow and rising, laughing in the face of industry. Mm. And that's that.